Meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the RPM subteam for URS documents call on Wednesday, the 25th of July, 2018. Attendance for today's call will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Thank you. Hearing no names, I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn it over to Brian Beckham. You may begin.
Thank you, Andrea, and welcome everyone. First, are there any questions with respect to the agenda for today or any updates to statements of interest? Okay, hearing none. I want to just make sure that that we have on the record, Phil, of course, is on vacation, so don't expect to see him. And David McCauley sent me a note a little while ago to say that he was on a registry stakeholder group call, and that was running over, but he would try to get on as quickly as he could once that wraps up. And I know we have one item, which is the remedies to get through appeals, where David had done some helpful research. So hopefully by the time we get through this first item, David will have joined us. If not, of course, you will have seen that the staff had circulated a note kind of summarizing some of the discussion between David and a few other sub-team members on some of the questions around de novo appeal, reviews, appeals, that sort of thing. And so I think we can probably cover that off, but hopefully David will be here. So without further ado, because we do have our work cut out for us to get through the second half of this document today, if you remember, we went through the first half of this document last week, which started with the complaint that took us right through to the notice, that took us through to the response, followed by the standard of proof, and we covered off the defenses, and we'll pick up today with F, the remedies. And so I know there are a few people on this call who are joining us that have been involved in some of the other sub-teams. I know I see Jason in the attendance who was chairing one of the sub-teams. And so we thought it would be useful just to make sure we're kind of covering all the bases if people from other sub-teams join us. And so with that, the way, just for people who weren't here last time, the way that we went through this was that Barry and I sort of tag-teamed walking through this document because, of course, he's much handier at manipulating the Adobe and flicking us back and forth between the documents. And so what we did was we basically went through, for those of you that are new to our sub-team here, we went through the final column there on the right where part of our work on this sub-team was to go through this URS documents chart and to identify sources of data that might help fill out some of those questions, the charter questions that we, if you remember, we started to kind of reformulate those, I want to say about 6 months or so ago. And so this was an attempt to go through those reformulated questions into the various groupings that we had come up with and to identify sources of documents that would be helpful to inform our discussions. We had concluded that after the first few weeks of our sub-team, and so what we've been doing last week and what we'll do this week is we'll go through point by point the items on that final column on the right and actually look at the information we've identified and see if there are things we wanted to flag up to the broader working group, and then, of course, the idea is that this feeds into a draft initial report, whether these are items we want to, say this is our policy recommendation or this is an open question we have for the community to seek feedback on. So with that, Barry, if you can, we are on F, the remedies. So the of the sources that we had identified, we had the provider's experiences in terms of the remedies, and there we had the provider responses on page 25, rows 105 to 108.
Hi, Brian. Barry Cobb for the record. Just real quick, I wanted to just briefly walk through a recap of what we accomplished last week. The primary thing that I'd like to point out for the group is Mary went through the document after last call and essentially is trying to summarize for each one of the data sources that we had identified of trying to put down the preliminary recommendation or, you know, a summary statement of what this subgroup had found that will be extracted into a summary doc that will then be presented to the full working group next week. So, for example, what you'll see here in the window, just to, for the those that are new versus those that were on the call last week, I'm sharing my screen mostly because we'll be flipping through three or four documents quite a bit. The way the Adobe Connect room is set up, the pod that you see my screen shared, there is the option to expand that to full screen. It's in the top right corner for you, and it will basically paint your entire screen of what you see of my screen. You can toggle in between those if you need to then return to the chat and type something in there. But it'll probably make it a little bit easier for you to be able to read what I'm sharing. So, for example, from last week, the very first data source that we had identified under the complaint was basically asking from the provider subteam about any stats of pass-fail that they have regarding the administrative review. And what I had done prior to last week's call was basically conduct an inventory across all of our data sources to find that particular relevant data and create a pointer to it. We would, for example, then move over to the provider's table, which in this case was specifically page 11, rows 30 and 31. What is new from last week, as I mentioned, Mary went through and tried to capture a summary statement. So, for instance, in this case, that the provider's feedback, and after us reviewing it, didn't seem to indicate any additional policy work as it relates to the administrative review. And so we're not going to spend time going through those. We'll repeat the same process after today's call, and when we send this back out to the list, we ask that the members of the group review these kind of summary findings, and if you have issues with them, please send to the list or make comments, or if you agree with basically the takeaway message. There were two or three as it relates to the complaint here. Like for the second one as an example, there was basically no feedback to support what was identified, and the third item and so on. So I won't go through these just because we do have a considerable amount to go through today, but I just, again, wanted to point that out for you. So per Brian's statement, we did conclude last week's call. And essentially, there's two sections here, Section D, Standard of Proof, and Section E, which is Defenses. And essentially, these two sections, in terms of data sources identified by this document subteam, they've been combined together. Thus, for the Defenses section, you'll see how it references back up above to Section D. And just to kind of recap on the Standard of Proof, we did go through the first data aspect, which was basically seeking qualitative experiences on how they thought the standard of proof was applied. We went through the practitioner survey and came up with a summary statement, basically that there didn't appear to need to be a modify the standard of proof or URS for the clear and convincing standard. But it may provide some guidance as to what constitutes clear and convincing evidence in light of different laws around the world. So that was kind of the takeaway from there. And then where we did actually stop was the secondary data source, which was this subteam was supposed to review the 58 cases where the respondent prevailed, in particular in relation to the grounds and defenses as mentioned in sections 5.7 and 5.8. to determine how the respondent prevailed and if not under one of the grounds of defenses mentioned, then what was the specific reason or what was the proof that was provided? So the first data source was that I had included in the staff compilation report of all the data that we've collected is kind of out of date, but earlier in the week, I think two or three days ago, Mary had sent that analysis of reviewing through these 51 cases. So first and foremost, I made a little note to the side that after we have reviewed these 58 cases, I will import that back over into the staff compilation doc of all the data that we've taken care of. And as we work through this, you'll see me either confirm, edit, or remove some of the comments on the right just so that we're keeping track of where we're at. So, for example, you'll see me deleting a couple of those because we basically have this note here that, you know, this is work in progress. So I'm going to bring up the summary that Mary had put together. And essentially, you know, the task here again was to review these cases where the respondent prevailed. There's a slight summary about the statistical extract. So essentially there were 59 cases to review, and there's a table below this statistical extract. The left-hand side is the claim cases where the claim was denied, but it did contain a response, and there's information about when that response was, when it occurred. And then to the right of this gray bar over here is the cases where the claim was denied, but there was no response made. And as you work down the rows, you'll see each case number, what the determination was, and if there's also some notes in column 5 about the result determination that when Mary had looked through these. As of now, this analysis is not complete. This is still work in progress, but we thought it'd be worth going through. And just as a reminder as well, how we got to the data that we did. First and foremost, there was an analysis about responses in general. Those responses, and I'll just to remind everybody here, I'm looking at the staff compilation report, and let me find it. So there was an analysis done based on the responses that was further classified by the determination, whether the claim was denied, suspended with a split decision, or withdrawn. And in particular, it's this area that we're looking at. And it was basically based on Rebecca's team and the coding that they had done. They identified whether the response was within 14 days or if it was within 6 months or not applicable, meaning there was no response identified on the case material from the provider's site. So that's what allowed us to make this distinction between these two columns of this analysis. The next part of the analysis from Rebecca's coding exercise, there are several columns on her spreadsheet that I'll just briefly show you real quick that are contained in a section of the coding itself labeled as the case analysis. And in there are specifically questions that were asked. As an example, if a response was filed, what defenses or facts were submitted to refute bad faith allegation? Or conversely, if the determination was in the complainant's favor, you know, what constituted the bad faith conduct? And for each one of the cases that they reviewed, they have a coding matrix that would help try to identify generalized buckets by which these could be assigned. And so this is, when you look down on page 4 of this particular document, I've extracted what those codes were. And so in the case of column Alpha Gulf, which again is if the response was filed, what defense was used, Essentially, they, you know, coding number one was the registrant's use of the domain is for a bona fide offering of good or services, et cetera. And then conversely, if the complainant failed, there are a set of codes that they used over there as well. And so further down in this document, there's a pivot table of essentially trying to organize and view this data in a different way so that we can kind of tabulate what the defenses were in this particular case. So as an example, this fourth row, they used both code number one and code number four, code one being the use of the domain is for a bona fide offering of goods or services, and code four, the domain is generic descriptive and the registrant is making fair use. So four of those cases of the 28 where there was a response, those two codings were used. And in addition, one other thing that I'd like to point out is that there was also a column from Rebecca's coding research, which was more kind of free form, which was additional notes on those responses if it was required. And so this list that you see below this table is just an export of what some of those free-form text was extracted from the case so that they could understand either what the respondent argued or what the examiner had placed into the case itself. And so the last thing before I turn it back over to Brian is to go back to the summary up here. So, again, basically the statistical extract. So of the 59 cases, 28 saw a response. Of the 28 cases where a response was filed, 6 were filed after the 14-day response period but before the 6-month time frame expired. And of the 6 cases where a response was filed before the 6-month period, 5 cases saw a complaint fail on both no legitimate right or interest and bad faith. And only one saw the respondent prevailing simply on the complaint's inability to prove bad faith. And so, again, just a reminder, what we're trying to understand here is if there are any potential changes needed as it relates to the defenses that are already defined in Sections 5.7 and 5.8. So I'll turn that back over to you, Brian.
Yeah, thanks, Barry, and this is Brian for the record. I think for us the task here is really to go through this catalog of the defenses used in responses and see if there are any. I think, frankly, the task is, and this is difficult, it's really in the realm of proving a negative, but to see if there are any defenses that are not captured that should be. But bear in mind, of course, that these were drawn largely from the EDRP and other dispute resolution systems, for example, Nominet. And a lot of these defenses, they've been in place for, in some cases, almost 20 years. And, of course, they are non-exclusive. So, you know, just because these are kind of illustrative examples doesn't mean that parties can't advance other grounds for either a complaint or a response. So with that, and I wanted to mention just to kind of, you know, already look ahead a little bit. After this call, we'll go through this again with staff and produce draft recommendations in a next iteration of this document. And, of course, we'll cover this off by email, but really want to make sure that everybody has it on their radar that this is the time to go through the document, to look at the recommendations, to see if there's something you think is missing, needs to be reworded before it's reported up to the working group, before it starts to work its way into the initial report. So really want to just urge people to when the next iteration of this document comes out to really go through this and look at the recommendations and see if there's anything based on your following the work of this working group that you think that isn't in there that needs to be or something that needs to be reframed. So that takes us to F, which is the remedies, which is where we left off last time. And we one of the first source of data that we had identified was the provider's experiences. That takes us to the provider question responses. That was page 25 of that document. And so that would be Barry, rows 105 to 108. So in terms of the provider responses, as you guys can hopefully see, it's a little small on the screen. Maybe you have a printout like I do. It looks like, frankly, the providers didn't have a lot to say by way of weighing in on the scope of remedies, and that's not entirely surprising. So that takes us through the first two bullets and sub-bullet points, and then if everyone agrees, I think we can kind of draw a line under this to say that the providers didn't have a tremendous amount to say on with respect to the remedies. Of course, they're there to manage the process, and that doesn't really get too much into what should happen at the end of that process. So the next bullet on this column was the URS document subteam to review the IRT and STI reports. And I apologize, it's a little buried because of the way the comments kind of merged together. But I went through and read through the IRT and STI reports and chose a few quotes that I thought were kind of on point when it comes to discussing the remedies. And certainly I would invite people to have a look at those quotes, have a look at the reports themselves. There are links in the comments. I'll say two things about this. One is the IRT report was more in the form of a narrative. So they walked you through, for example, their thought process. So they said, you know, we're tasked with coming up with a rights protection mechanism for new GTLDs. One of them is to complement the UDRP because they were, you know, if you remember at the time, there was a lot of questions about, you know, how is the UDRP going to scale across a lot of new GTLDs. And so the idea was to come up with an alternative that was kind of less burdensome on everybody involved to complement the UDRP. And then the STI report, basically what they did was they created a chart which went through the component pieces of the IRT report and signaled whether there was consensus within that STI group or not on each particular element. And I will say, you know, having reviewed it myself, for the most already codified. So with that, this is really, I don't know exactly what, I'm seeing Barry or Griffin's comment in the chat, and I know a few people have come on and off of mute. Are you hearing me okay at the moment? So basically, just to summarize, the RT report, I don't know what particular data points we can draw off that. Mainly the kind of the summary was that they were coming up with something that a complement to the UDRP, and so there was sort of a threshold question: if it's a quicker mechanism, if it's a cheaper mechanism, if it has a higher standard of proof, it has, you know, some things like a relation to the trademark clearinghouse and SMD files. You know, the question was it right to, with the lighter process and the higher standard of proof, to have the same remedy as the URS? And that group, the IRT, of course, and came out with a recommendation that it was better to have a different remedy to signal the difference in the two mechanisms, and, of course, the STI supported that. So I think that, frankly, that's really more of a philosophical policy question than something that, you know, there's going to be a tremendous amount of data. It's something that people, brand owners, might have a view that they should have a transfer remedy or right of first refusal. Others may think that it's inappropriate to transfer the domain name to the brand owner without a more robust process. So I'm certainly open to see if people want to discuss this, but I think there's not really a tremendous amount to discuss in terms of looking back at the IRT and STI reports. It's pretty clear, I think, that people understand that they struck a balance between the lightness of the mechanism and the remedy. So unless there are comments on that, the next item was to review what happened once the domain names were suspended. And if you remember, there was a chart prepared some time ago that looked at when the suspension ended, what happened? Was the domain name re-registered? Was it registered by the brand owner? Was it registered by the initial registrant to second registrant? Was it sitting dormant? And from memory, they were sort of, there were domain names in all of those categories. So I think Barry has that on the screen for us. And so this is one for us to see, are there conclusions that we wanted to draw from looking at what happens afterwards after the suspension ends? And of course, you know, if we look at it and we see a certain number were re-registered by the original registrant, maybe that points us to a recommendation that it ought to be transferred to keep it out of hands of someone who's been found to be infringing. If it's not re-registered, maybe that says that the URS is working as intended. It's lighter. The domain name suspended. If nobody, the brand owner, the registrant wants it, then that's fulfilling its purpose. And I see, Barry, you have your hand raised, so please go ahead.
Thank you, Brian. Barry Cobb for the record. So just to put a little bit more explanation to this, before you at the very beginning is a summary of initial findings. We'll come back to that in just a second. But essentially, this part of the analysis is split two different tables. The table on the left is by domain name, meaning, you know, that there are several cases out there that had more than one domain. And the table on the right is just by cases. That is further then broken down by the determination. So, again, you know, whether the claim was denied, whether there was a split decision, whether the domain was suspended, or whether that whether the case slash domains were withdrawn. And below that is, I won't go through the details here, but there's a methodology that kind of explains how we got to this. Essentially, in short, what happened is I extracted all the domains from the case. I went and acquired a fresh query of Whois data. First and foremost, that Whois data would tell us whether the domain was still registered or not. If it's not registered, then obviously you'll see, like here, the domain was registered as no, and it's not registered. And if it was registered, then essentially going through and analyzing either the name servers or any information in the registrant data that would reveal as to the outcome of that domain, meaning was it still under suspension, where most of these were contained the name servers, URSforum.com. I can't remember what the exact name was, but it was an easy indication that the domain was still suspended, whereas some of the others were indicative that the domain was recovered either by the brand itself that or the complainant that had filed the domain or through a brand protection company like CSC or Mark Monitor and the like. And there's also some definitions on these codes. For example, the easy one is suspended. Obviously, that domain is still in suspension as a result of the URS, not registered, brand protection, etc. So there's quite a bit to unpack here, but the short takeaway that we get from this is, so there were a total of 827 cases for a total of 1,861 domains at the conclusion of 2017. So 28% of the cases, or 59% of the disputed domains, the disposition is still labeled as suspended. So that's quite a big amount. And, you know, for the most part, again, the domain is typically suspended for 1 year, but there are instances where the domain was already registered for multiple years, or in some cases, the domain was renewed to continue the suspension. But a very large chunk of those domains are still in the suspension state. And I would just note here, which is the footnote number 6, one case contained 457 domains for Ashley Furniture, and another case was 202 domains for Cialis, all of which are suspended. So that's a total of almost 650 domains of the 1,745 that make up this classification of suspension. And then to continue on further, 27% of the total cases, or 17% of the domains disputed, the domain is no longer registered, where most of them were suspended after the complainant prevailed, which ultimately means that the complainant chose not to recover or re-register the domain or pick it up under brand protection. And then the last kind of summary of initial findings is 30% of the cases, or 16% of the domains that disputed, the complainant used brand protection either from a provider, a protected marks list, or the name was reserved with the registry. So those are some high-level takeaways. Thank you, Brian. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. That's really interesting to see that the buckets that they fall into. So this is really our opportunity here, everyone on the call, to see if you have any thoughts on, you know, you see, broadly speaking, of course, there are a lot of details, but broadly speaking, about a third of them, they're still suspended. About a third, they're no longer registered. And then about a third, they're registered, whether that's directly or through some sort of a DPML type of a scheme. So with that background, do folks have any thoughts on any conclusions we can draw from the status of domains once the case has run its course? And it could be that I know this theme has come up. This is Brian again. That with some of the aspects of the URS, because we don't have heaps of cases like we do under the UDRP after now almost 20 years, it may be that this is an area where we flag in the initial report that this can be looked at in the future if there's a further review, or it could be one where it's less of a data driven. Point, but something that people have more of a policy philosophy on. So unless people have sorry, I see Jason has his hand up. Jason, please go ahead, and then Barry, you've mentioned in the chat. Jason?
Hi, Brian. Thank you. Jason Schaefer for the record. And forgive me, this is my first time participating on your call, so I'm not familiar with these documents, but I just wanted to, and maybe Barry could answer this. Earlier there was, you know, some discussion that there's indication that in some cases the losing party, the losing registrant, ends up re-registering the domain. Is there, it doesn't seem like that's a large percentage, though, and is there a column here that indicates that? Has that been determined? Barry, perhaps you can opine on that?
Yes. So let me first state that this analysis is a snapshot in time. It's a very dynamic nature because these domains are coming on suspension, off the suspension, picked up by the brand, or not registered. So, you know, there's a decent chance that easily 10% of the domains here have changed since I did this analysis at the end of May. Specifically, to answer your question, Jason, I only found one instance, one domain, and one case where the domain was re-registered by the respondent, by the respondent of the case. And looking at that particular domain this isn't a definitive analysis or conclusion, but at least to me it looked like the domain was being used for a purpose not in bad faith. I can't remember what the exact use of the domain was. So I think in that particular instance, the respondent, you know, felt that, you know, that he should have never had the domain suspended, but he went back and re-registered it. Now, there are... In this suspended aspect, where the domain is registered, but either the domain doesn't resolve, is parked, or it has a website or forwards in these cases, so probably about 250 domains of the 1,861. Unfortunately, I didn't have the time to go look through the Whois history on these domains, but it is very likely that these domains were could be re-registered by a different registrant, but not the original registrant. But again, in conclusion to your answer, I only found one instance, one domain, where it was technically re-registered by the respondent of the case.
Okay, thank you, Barry. That's helpful. Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, looking at this data set and what Brian had explained and you, I think that there's some useful information here, certainly. And, you know, yes, perhaps we can flag it, but it, from my take on this, again, just coming at it from this call, it looks like the U.S. seems to be working, and the complaining parties are either choosing not to register or are registering, or the brand protection firms are or not choosing to follow up with these names. Maybe they're not worth it. Maybe they are, but it seems like this, you know, between the percentages, it seems to be working quite well. But that's how I see this. But thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, thanks, Jason, and thanks, Barry. This is Brian again. And I go ahead, Barry.
Please go ahead, and then I was going to just also introduce the second part of this analysis that may be helpful to the group as well.
Okay, yeah, so I was just going to say that it does look like that with the way that these are being managed after the suspension ends, I think Jason points us to a reasonable conclusion that it does, the suspension remedy, of course, because remember we're in the remedy section, that does seem to be fulfilling its intended purpose. Either it's still in play, neither party, strangely, the person who originally registered it and has a chance to re-register it, nor the complainant who had it taken down, wants it in about a third of the cases, and then some are under brand protection. So I think, unless people feel differently, I think that could be a reasonable conclusion to draw, that the suspension remedy is doing what it's meant to be doing here. And people, of course, some people may want to have a different remedy, but then there are different rights protection mechanisms that can be used for that. So does anyone have any thoughts on any other conclusions we can draw from the statistics on what happens after the suspension and what that means for our views on the remedy? And I see Jerry Levine has put a comment in the chat that there are a good number of rights holders choosing the UDRP rather than the URS. And so maybe that's just something we bear in mind when we're pulling together a recommendation here. And I know, Barry, you had your hand raised.
Yes. And so to respond to Mr. Levine's comments, in that case, for those cases where the claim was denied, and, you know, I was still pulling the Whois record for those domains, at least 10 of those cases I guess as a side note, mostly for when the working group returns back to the review of the TMCH Sunrise and claims, I have now extracted all of the UDRP cases for new GTLDs, and I have the quantity, so they're not contaminated with .coms, nets, and other TLDs, and the ultimate goal is to be able to marry that up with some of the claims information. But what I did find in looking through this analysis against the URS cases, at least where these claims were denied, 10 cases did pop up being over in or a UDRP was filed and the complainant prevailed over there in the UDRP. The second thing that I'll point out here just real quick, and there's really no summary takeaway of this information, but when I was looking through the domains and extracting the Whois information, I thought it was an error, but it turned out that there are about 17 or so domains where they showed up twice under different URS cases. So, for example, wolfram.ceo, the very first claim was denied, and the comments over here was is basically a lack of evidence on the relationship between the complainant and Wolfram Group LLC. Later that month, they filed a second URS, and then they prevailed. So essentially, the domains listed on the left, column to the case number, column three is the outcome, whether, you know, it was denied, final suspension, default suspension, and then the fourth column being the case date, and then any comments about that. And so I would ask the working group to maybe take a look at this. I think for the most part it seemed as though things were working more or less as designed, but it might benefit the group to kind of peer under the hood a little bit more to see if they can extract if there's any other issues coming on here. But again, it was basically about 17 domains across, 34 total cases. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. And this is Brian again, just to kind of draw this together a little bit. Jerry, was there anything that you wanted to add other than the comment in your chat, the notion that there were more UDRP cases than URS cases? Would you say that there's any particular policy conclusion we should draw from that in terms of whether the URS, the suspension remedy, is right for the URS? Or maybe that's just an observation that people prefer one or the other. And maybe while you're thinking about that, Jerry, I see Greg Shatton has his hand raised. Greg?
Thank you. Greg Shatton for the record. I think following on Jerry's comment, what we can't really tell from this data is, you know, who did not use the URS and why. And that's... the issue is whether the suspension remedy is so inconsequential or insufficient that the URS is, in essence, is not working because it's not capturing enough cases that would use it. That has to be weighed, of course, against the reasoning about why, given the lightweight nature of the URS, the remedy was thought to be appropriate, but that doesn't make the remedy adequate. But, of course, data that's gleaned from users of the URS and providers and the like is not going to tell us who stayed away. But just because it, in a sense, it worked when it was used doesn't mean that it works overall. You know, an unpopular car can be said to work even if it's a dog on the market, unless, of course, it's exploding. That doesn't mean it's, you know, it has the necessary components or ramifications that those who would think about using it will actually use it. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. And this is Brian again. And I know Cynthia has made a comment in the chat that maybe some of these are picked up by Dropcatch. I think if Greg, actually, that's maybe a useful segue to our next data point, which is looking at the INTA survey and the CCTRT report. I think, frankly, that this question about, you know, which cases are not filed, certainly I can say for us, we're seeing healthy numbers of UDRP cases filed. So maybe people prefer to use that because there's a different remedy. But you know, I think this is really a big picture question for us, and you know, people are going to have different views, and that can be informed by the presence of data or the lack of data. So I think, you know, maybe just because I know we're halfway through the call and we're still on the first item that we meant to get through, unless people feel strongly otherwise. And I see Jerry's put a comment in the chat agreeing with Greg in terms of the remedy and what it means for potential filing parties. And so just to move us along to the next two bullet points, the INTA survey and the CCTRT report, I went through there and you see there's, and I'm sorry that part of the comment is cut off, but you see INTA had surveyed its members not all of its members replied, of course, but the URS, you see, that wasn't rated as the most popular RPM, and maybe that's for the reasons that Greg and Jerry have identified. You see some of the comments that I've picked out of the INTA survey were people calling this a whack-a-mole, and I think that really gets to this question of the remedy. Again, I think we're kind of retracing well-worn ground here. Then to take us to the next bullet, which is the CCTRT report, I think basically what I, and this was a very lengthy report, and there were only a few pages dedicated to rights protection. And I would say overall my takeaway, and please feel free to, there's again a link in the comment, and I've selected some quotes. And again, some of these retrace this ground about, you know, is the remedy appropriate, et cetera. But overall, the question from the CCTRT report was that, you know, there should be some questioning given to how the URS and the UDRP interoperate. And I think largely this comes down to the remedy, and this is something where people are going to have divergent views on what's the appropriate remedy. And I see George has put a comment in the chat that, that this was a question that came up in the practitioner survey. And I, Barry, is that your comment above George's? Is that an old hand raise, or is that
no, it's
new?
It's new. I just like to point out here, though, that, you know, in the discussion of the remedy, the group might want to consider that maybe somewhat of an education problem than necessarily an insufficient remedy for suspension. And it is kind of unfortunate that there's still a number of cases that are still in the suspension state. I think this would be a worthy analysis to conduct a year or two from now. But for the most part, you know, because the domain's not being re-registered, I think is a fairly good indication that the complainant or brand in respect to that particular complaint is choosing not to re-register it, perhaps due to registration costs, whereas there is still a significant number of complainants or brands that are picking up these domains either themselves or through their brand protection company that, in effect, is the equivalent of the outcome of UDRP and perhaps still a cheaper alternative. And so, you know, I think the group ought to consider that if there was a potential recommendation that the remedy be changed, that all of the domains are transferred like in the UDRP, is that something that a lot of brands really want, given the higher cost associated with domains and new GTLDs? So, again, I'd just like to point out that in looking through this analysis, it was pretty clear that in the earlier days of URS, some of the brands chose not to pick it up. For example, Lufthansa is a great example. They didn't pick up several of the domains. Now they are. And when they filed subsequent URSs. So that's just something that the group ought to consider. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Barry. This is Brian again. And I've taken the liberty of, while Barry was speaking, of putting a comment in the chat. I think this is something where it would certainly be useful to see what's happening a year from now, 2 years from now, with these names that are suspended presently. And that, of course, can help inform our discussion about how the URS and the UDRP are meant to work together in some respects and meant to be different in other respects. So unless people have a burning desire to have more discussion about the remedies, I think that moves us to the next section, which is the appeals processes. And I see Barry put a comment that I was actually thinking this, Barry, this is Brian again, the question about future analysis and who is data. And of course, when Jason was mentioning the sole case of a re-registration by a respondent, of course, that's going to become more difficult in the future. I didn't want to invoke the GDPR, but of course that's something that we have to be aware of, that this might not be such an easy task in the future. To see if people are, in fact, re-registering domain names that were suspended. So with that, I think we can move on to the appeals processes. And if folks remember, one of the initial tasks of this subteam was to look at the 14 cases that contained an appeal, and we did that early on, and that analysis was provided some time ago, and we came to the conclusion that this seemed to be working as intended. There were a few cases where in the appeal the case was overturned either in one of the other parties' favor. So with that, the document sources that we had beyond those 14 cases, we had the third bullet there, the staff compilation report on pages 22 and 23.
Hi, Brian. So this is Barry. Just real quick, because some might be new to this, what we're looking at right now is the raw analysis or the raw data. Essentially what was done, we extracted the cases where, the 14 appeals occurred. The analysis was done in this particular column, or column C, which was the original case, and then compared it next to the appeal. And most of the outcome is highlighted in gray and bottom, which would basically just try to summarize, who prevailed at the case or at the appeal, and again, trying to understand what the disposition of the domain was after that, which did lead to, what's the page number again? Pages 22 and 23. Sorry for the scrolling. This probably hurts your eyes. So, on pages 22 and 23, there's basically a summary of findings here. Essentially, out of the 14 appeals, 7 were related to the .email GTLD. 6 of those 7, the respondent was in relation to the yoyo.email occurrence. Of the 6 yoyo.email appeals, 1 saw where the respondent prevailed on the appeal, which was for the domain stuartweitzman.email. The losing complainant subsequently filed a UDR proceeding and prevailed on that side. The only other .email case wasn't related to yoyo.email was for gray.email, and the respondent prevailed there and is essentially using the domain for his own purposes, but not in bad faith. Essentially, in total, out of the 14 appeals cases, the complainant ultimately prevailed in 12 of them. There were only 2 where the respondent prevailed, as just mentioned above. Of the 14, 9 appeals were heard by 3 member appeal panels. And then the following numbers show the final disposition of the domains. So 1 is in control of the respondent, which is the gray.email. 7 are in control of the complainant owned via brand protection. 3 are reserved by the registry or DPML. 2 are available for registration, meaning they were deleted and never registered again. And 3 still resolve to a suspension page. And then lastly, so out of the 14 appeals, there were 8 initial cases where the complainant first prevailed, which were later appealed by the respondent. 7 out of those 8 appeals resulted in the complainant prevailing, the one that didn't, again, the Stuart Weitzman email. And then out of the 14 appeals, there were 6 initial cases where the respondent had prevailed, which were later prevailed or appealed by the complainant, and 5 out of those 6, the complainant prevailed, the 6 being the different one, or the opposite one being the gray.email case. And then there's just kind of table results. I'll turn it back to you, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. This is Brian again. And so I think I would say from just looking at this snapshot, and of course we don't have a tremendous amount of data to draw from, It seems that the appeals are a bit of a grab bag. You have somewhere the complainant is winning, somewhere the respondent is winning, somewhere there's 3-member panels, somewhere where there's a single-member panel. And one of the things that we identified earlier in the broader working group was the idea of some sort of guidance for panelists around jurisprudence like we have for the UDRP in the WIPA overview. And, you know, frankly, my personal view is that, that it may be too early to have the URS cases coalesce around some jurisprudential principles, although you would think that that wouldn't stray too far from what's happened in the UDRP. But with, I think maybe just in the interest of time, you know, we've spent a good deal of time in this sub-team looking at these appeals, and then we've reported that up to the broader working group. And the next thing we were going to look at was the cases where a de novo review occurred. And I know David McCauley had looked into this, and there was a good exchange on the list with some suggestions for, you know, maybe some clarity around languages or timelines of different appeals and review processes, or consolidating those into one process versus the, if I understand correctly, there are kind of three different avenues for the appeal or the review to take place. So, Barry, maybe while you're putting us over to the compilation report, David, if you wanted to share with us some of the observations that you had drawn from the review of these de novo cases, that would be really helpful.
David, if you're speaking, we can't hear you.
Boy, my apologies. I was on mute, a rookie mistake. David McCauley speaking for the record. Thanks, Brian. I would like to, you know, I took off to look at these cases that were listed on the email, Brian, and came to a little bit late, so I apologize to the group that I haven't done a statistical input or statistical analysis as Barry's done very well in some of these other things, but I do have observations coming from my review of the 10 cases that were listed as de novo reviews. And the first thing I would observe is they're not all de novo reviews. Some of those cases are actually appeals under Rule 12 of the procedures. Substantively, so my report here is a bit anecdotal, having read 10 of these cases. Substantively, I think that Brian used a good term to describe these. It's a bit of a grab bag, not only in the fact that some are three-member panels and others are single-member panels, but also in the fact that, you know, they tend to discuss the substance of a URS appeal and what happened, et cetera, reasonably well and what might be expected. I came away, however, with a number of administrative things I think we can tidy up, and then some policy questions that we might consider in this sub-team for suggesting to the overall group. So I'll go through this fairly quickly in the interest of time, but the things I'm interested in administratively are in the nature of coming up with a form for an examination determination. And the reason I say that is if you read through these things, they're extraordinarily difficult to sift through. And possibly that's because these examiners are not paid all that much to do this, but the nomenclature, the labeling throughout a decision is extremely poor. Referring to the parties is extremely poor. You know, there should be a term that's used, such as appellant-respondent or complainant below. That's not done. And I've actually read one case, I think, where the terms were confused within the case itself. We could come up with a list of suggestions for people writing these decisions. Basic writing suggestions like have some white space, don't have a 502-word paragraph on the findings of fact. You know, in single font, small font, single spacing. It's just absurd to try and read through these things. I also think on the form, the procedural history, which is part of the form, should include the actions below. These are all appeals of some sort, either de novo or an actual appeal. Indicate what happened beforehand, and most of these cases don't do that. Policy-wise, the questions I have are, should somebody who defaults effectively get three bites at an examination? Here's what I mean. Under Rule 6, if somebody defaults, the examiner can't simply close the case and say default judgment based on not responding. They have to look at the complainant's filing and do an examination based on that. So there's an examiner and an examination that results in a default setting. If somebody defaults, they have up to a year after that examination to file for a de novo review under paragraph 6. And again, that's just like a new trial. They get to submit a reply and have the case reheard. And then that determination for the third instance of examination would be appealable under Rule 12. Somebody who does not default gets two examinations, two examiners. The defaulter has three examiners, and I think more of a chance to find one examiner that agrees with him or her. I think we ought to look at that and decide, does that really make sense? The other thing I would mention about default cases, if somebody defaults and they have then a year to ask for de novo review, and if they wait 11 months and 29 days, they get to file a response and the case will be heard as if it's initial an examination. The complainant has no explicit right, at least, to rebut. Now, they wouldn't in the first case anyway, but a year has passed. So I wonder, do we think that the passage of a year gives an unfair advantage to someone's filing a response? I don't know. The answer may be no, but it just seems odd to me. I think it might be good to look at fees. I also think we need to look at cross-referencing Rules 6 and Rule 12. I think there's confusion amongst them. And I think I'll leave it at that for now, Brian, but I came away from this sort of anecdotal reading of 10 cases thinking there's a number of administrative fixes that would be fairly easy that we could suggest, and there are some policy questions we might propose. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much, David. That's a very good quick takeaway of what's gone on here. And I wanted to just note for our collective benefit that actually a lot of the questions that you've just raised, David, dovetail nicely with the next section in our review, which is potentially overlapping process steps. And so there were two suggestions. One had to do with more of a kind of a terminology nature, and then one with a procedural nature. And just to kind of summarize also from the email exchange, largely with you, David, and Paul Keating, there was this question about multiple bites at the apple, and this, of course, had some timeline implications. What do folks think about this summary of these various de novo appeals and reviews? Do people agree with David's summary that there's a need for some precision in terms, maybe even a suggestion that the cases themselves follow some sort of a pattern? And then, of course, there was more of a policy type question about the overlapping nature of these types of appeals and reviews and the various timelines that they entailed. I know, Rebecca, in your research, and this is sort of jumping between the section on the appeals and the potentially overlapping process steps. In the notes on our column here, it says refer to Section C notes where it looks at your research. And I know in about a quarter of those cases there was a response, and about a quarter of those were within the 14 days. I wonder, Rebecca, Barry, anyone on the call, if you have any observations from looking at Rebecca's detailed spreadsheet, whether on the one hand the various timelines for the appeals and reviews are appropriate, and then on the other hand, whether it may be efficient to think about consolidating those into one kind of more unified framework. And with that, I see that Mary has her hand up. Mary, please.
Thanks, Brian. This is Mary. I see Rebecca and David have their hands up. So since staff just wanted to clarify certain observations, I'm happy to go after the two members, if that's better.
Thanks, Mary. Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Toshnet. So I think it's a fantastic idea to have a much clearer templates, understanding of what should be in there and what people should be called and so on. To the extent that we can either produce or direct the production of those, I'm very strongly in support of that. I think that for a quick and dirty procedure designed for the easiest cases, though, it's a real mistake to say, oh, we can get rid of, you know, a level of scrutiny. The reason that the examiner is supposed to look at the affirmative case, even if there is a default, is in part, you know, we still don't know what, if any, the notice problems are. And we want to know that the complaint, you know, has made out its case of bad faith, which it's supposed to do even if nobody shows up in opposition. So that makes sense. I think the treatment of default, initial default, makes a lot of sense. It's consistent with what happens, at least in the U.S. legal system. If you have a default that is excused under whatever the rules are, then you get to make your case. We don't call it two bites at the apple because you didn't get a first bite. You defaulted for whatever reason. And then you have an appeal. Now, should we change the wording on those? Sure. But the standard of review seems to me to be appropriate. I have no strong feelings about, you know, what the labels are. But, you know, with the person, I also don't have too much worry about the lapse of time, in part because, you know, we have a suspension and a lock going on. So it's hard for me to imagine what is going to go wrong behind the scenes. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. And I see David McCauley has his hand up. David?
Thanks, Brian. Excuse me. It's David McCauley again. And I'll just say that I saw that comment, and with respect, I disagree with Rebecca on this one. I do think that the examination in a default case is something that's substantive. And I actually think that the default itself is sort of a shot, you know, that there's proper notice. Maybe we could argue about whether the notice period is sufficiently right or long enough. But the examination is a substantive step, in my view. It is something that, you know, I think maybe a solution here would be a direct appeal from a default to an appeal if the respondent wants to step in and forget the de novo review. It just seems to me that they do have three bites at the apple, to use a phrase, that a non-defaulter doesn't. And it just strikes me as unfair in some basic way. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David. And I see Greg Schatten.
Thanks. Greg Schatten for the record, just briefly. This is kind of a corollary to what David just said, is that when Rebecca compared the two bites to the apple or not the two bites to the apple to the U.S. legal system, while we're treating the default itself as we might, in other words, the second stage, in a U.S. legal case, the first default is not does not result in an examination or, you know, any looking at the merits. It's just so sad, too bad, and you lose the case because you didn't show up, which is why the second step works the way it does in the U.S. legal system. So in this case, we're kind of having it both ways for the missing respondent. They get an examination without showing up, which they could very well win, and they get treated in a default as if they just got the door slammed in their face. So we can't, we shouldn't have it both ways, or at least we shouldn't think that it's that the comparison holds water, so that we, you know, to decide how many times you get kind of a free shot. We could go to the U.S. system and say a default is just a default and go away, and come back if you can, or we can, you know, go with kind of the free examination even if you don't show up, and not treat the default as if they got shut out. Those are things that should be kind of, you know, looked at. Thank you.
Hi, this is Kathy. I'm on audio only. May I join the queue, please?
Please, Kathy, you're actually first in the queue, so please go ahead.
Actually, I think I'm behind Mary, so I'd be happy to wait.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mary?
Thanks very much, Kathy and Brian. This is Mary from staff. So obviously it is not for staff to have a view or make any recommendation. That is for the subteam and the working group as to what is fair or unfair or as to what an improvement may be. But just blow up on Barry's presentation, we did look through all of the 29 cases that were identified through Rebecca's coding. And for the most part, we see where David McCauley's suggestions for the administrative changes come about. There are examiners that, if I may be permitted to say so, are perhaps better in terms of being clearer as to their grounds and as to their rationale. There are one or two cases, not many, just a couple, where not only is it not clear, but the reasons are not actually clearly stated. So for those reasons, if there is going to be a template or some kind of form or a way to organize the way that the examiners detail their decision, it probably can be done in a way that is still streamlined in the way the URS is intended to be, but it can also be much more consistent across the cases. So that's one observation. Another observation that we'll make from looking at the 29 cases, and this is in our view, and it can be something that Renee and the forum can confirm, if you look at the URS rules, for example, there is the ability for final determinations to replace the default as published on the website, and it is up to the examiner. He has a discretion as to whether that should be the case or whether both should be published together. We have not been able to tell on the face of some of the records whether that was indeed done. So that's why if you look at the document that we have produced, there are 13 instances where we saw both the default and the final published. We've listed them as such. Of the remaining 16 out of 29 cases, we only saw the final determination. And it's not clear on the face of the record whether this replaces the default determination or not. It may be fairly obvious. The answer may be yes. But it may be something to consider to just have one line from the provider when publishing it saying there was a default, it was replaced, or something like that. So we did look through all the 29 cases. We hope that the table summary is helpful. And so just a couple of observations from the staff side. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Mary. And Kathy, you're next, please.
Great. Thanks. Kathy Kleiman, and the administrative changes make sense, as does what Mary's saying about clarifying if a final determination is replacing a default. All of this makes sense, certainly knowing who the parties are. That's crazy that's not clear. But as a member of the SCI, and fully with that hat on, I wanted to explain some of what was going on when these tiers were created. So there was a real concern about the speed of the in which a URS is being done. What we heard from registered attorneys is that even the UDRP is barely enough time to respond, and often they get called in at the last minute because it takes a long time to find an internet attorney. So the URS is a very, very fast proceeding. There's no personal jurisdiction. There's really insufficient time. You're working across jurisdictions, across languages, across new parts of the world. We were thinking all about those things in the STI. So we figured with the default, you were probably likely to lose, and which is the case, right? But the notice, once you're suspended, that may be your first notice that there was actually a proceeding going on against you. And so that ability to rebring, to bring that, and for the first time, to express why you're using that, that extra time may be the time that you find somebody who can speak English, maybe the time, you know, that you figure out what this process is that you've never heard of before or find someone to help you. And then the idea that you have an appeal. The appeal was created across the board for everyone. And seems to be working from what I can ascertain for the limited numbers of times it's been used. So I just wanted to explain that real concern about timing, and if it's clearly abusive, it's clearly abusive, and it will probably be clearly abusive throughout this process. And also, there are fees. So when the respondent comes in, it's my understanding there are now fees. So if they're filing late for de novo review, there are fees as well as appeals. So it's going to be used sparingly. But this idea that everyone has the opportunity and has the right to a response, and that we wanted to make sure that was possible. Just wanted to share that. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Before I try to kind of summarize this and give us a little bit of a time check, does anyone have any additional thoughts on this? I don't see anyone in the queue. So maybe what I would suggest, and I don't mean to sort of say that this is how it has to be, but this is just my kind of summary of our discussion on this topic, is that it seems to be uncontroversial that people agree we can bring some clarity in terms of language and processes and the actual decisions, appeals decisions, whatever they're called themselves. And then there's a separate question about the timing and the different types of appeals or reviews. And I think, frankly, this is not a question that we're going to be able to answer here today. And I would even submit that it's probably a tall order that we're able to solve that in the full working group with a view towards pulling the initial report together. So unless people feel that I'm just completely off base here, what I'd like to suggest is that we take note that there's agreement on the need for some clarity around some terms and processes, and that we flag this for the full working group, of course, and with a view towards flagging it in the initial report, where this sounds to me, just listening to the different views that have been expressed here, that this is something that we actively want to solicit community input on in our initial report. So maybe can I just see, by way of show of hands or comments in the chat, if people find that a generally agreeable approach here, or maybe if just want to make sure I'm not misstating anything or taking us off in the wrong direction. I see David McCauley is agreeing with what I've just said. Thank you, David. And I just, in addition to that, I wanted to mention that, of course, we're 10 minutes left in this call. And so I wanted to see if people, we can, of course, have a conversation on this over email, but if people might be available for a follow-up call before next Wednesday when we meet as a full working group. Otherwise, because of the timing of this call, which coincides with the timing of the full working group, we would have to push back the meeting of the full working group. So maybe some of these topics we can cover over email. Maybe we can see if members of the subteam and of course, the people who are joining us from the other subteams can hold a call before next Wednesday. I'm certainly happy myself to try to make that happen. So with that, I think that covers the appeals, the de novo reviews, and the potentially overlapping process steps, which moves us to the cost item. So one of the areas that we had to look at data was from the practitioner survey. And I don't recall off the top of my head what the practitioner survey told us in terms of how people feel about the fees. But maybe, let's see, I'm sorry here, I'm just trying to read the comment here in the margin. Sorry, that was just about asking how we asked the question. Barry or anyone, do you happen to know, I don't see here in the chart which area within the practitioner survey. I see you have it on the screen. So it looks that basically you have a split of opinions. Some people probably feel, and this is the response fee, of course. So this was, I believe, when there's more than 15 domain names involved, the respondent would have to pay a fee. And so some people agree that that's appropriate. Some people didn't. And then some people didn't have, actually most people didn't seem to have an opinion on that, which unfortunately doesn't help us out very much. So there were two questions just for people's feedback here. The question of the cost allocation. So this is the response fee, the loser pay fee in 15 or more domain names. Whether people that were on the practitioner survey team or people on this sub-team have any views on any conclusions we can draw from the response fee for 15 cases or more?
Brian, this is Jason. I guess I can speak on behalf of the group that I'm chairing. I think you adequately noted, I believe it was 7 had no opinion whatsoever. So 4 agreed that it was fine and 1 disagreed. So I don't really think we can glean too much useful information out of that. If anything, people are ambivalent about the fee structure.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. This is Brian again. And I think maybe there's 2 questions there. One is the people's views on the fees generally, and then maybe there's a separate question, and I think, again, this falls, as with the de novo reviews, this is not something that we're going to be able to solve here today or possibly even in the working group. So maybe we want to flag for consideration in the initial report for community feedback whether people feel that 15-case threshold, if memory serves, that was a threshold that moved during the different iterations of the guidebook, the IRT, the STI. I think it may have been 25, and then it was moved down to 15. So maybe that's an area where we wanted to particularly seek community feedback. The next bullet point that we had was the URS provider questionnaire. And I think that's, I'm trying to look at, I think that's what Barry has on the screen for us. And so I think this really gets into the providers sort of opining on whether there ought to be a loser pays model or not. And it looks, I'm just trying to do a quick skim, that there look to be some questions about how that would work in practice. So the ADNDRC mentions escrow, and the forum mentions that in the majority of cases there actually is no response. And then they raise a question about collecting from a non-appealing respondent. I think this kind of dovetails on what the ADNDRC is raising. So, and of course, this was a question that, for those of you that were involved, you know, in the development of the IRT and STI reports, this was a question that was raised, which was, you know, how do you actually satisfy a judgment against someone who's not bothering to show up? And I know in certain CCTLDs, they actually have, I think in Belgium, for example, when you register a domain name, you authorize the registry to basically hold an advance, a little bit like when you go to a hotel and they say, we're going to put $100 on your card in case you take a bunch of candy bars and beers out of the mini bar. Then in some CCTLDs, they have the ability to charge the card that's on your account if you don't show up. So that's maybe one way to solve that. But I think this is one, frankly, where we really need community feedback on this question in terms of both the fee itself and the threshold for the response fee. That takes us, I know, I'm sorry we only have 5 minutes, but that takes us to the language question. And there were a number of sources of data identified. There were the providers' responses and of course, the practitioners. I don't know how folks feel about getting into this with only a couple of minutes left to go. Do people want to sort of call it a day and try to find another time for a phone call? Do people want to? I don't know if it's even possible for participants and staff to continue the call beyond the hour, the half hour. I'm happy to try to do that myself, but what do people think about parking this and trying to come back to it or trying to keep on moving? I'll just note that we have 5 additional items. So we have the language, we have the abuse of process, we have the education and training, we have the URS providers, and we have the alternative processes. So I see Cynthia says she's okay for another call. David can't go too far beyond. Maybe if it's okay with everybody, I think rather than get into the language, because I know this was one where I think probably we're going to have a decent amount of discussion, and we had some feedback I know from the providers, and I know Kathy had raised some questions that maybe we pick up on another call with this language question. So I see Mary's put in the chat if another call is scheduled, should this be before Wednesday? Yeah, I completely had the same question, Mary. For me, it's fine to do it next Wednesday at the same time. I'm reluctant to do that because it shifts the entire working group getting back together, and we really wanted to try to hold to that timeline. So maybe we can conduct a poll over email and see what would work for people. I'm certainly willing to make myself available as best I can, whether it's tomorrow, Friday, Monday, Tuesday. So maybe if people agree, we can go for a doodle poll, see what works for everybody, try to get that together, pick up with the language. We have a few items remaining. I think we hopefully don't need the full 90 minutes for this next subteam call, and then that'll have us in a good position to present our recommendations up to the full working group next Wednesday. So I see Mary said in the chat that we can send out a doodle poll. So with that, thanks everybody. Unless anybody has anything before we conclude tonight. Okay, sorry, I thought I heard someone trying to speak. So with that, thanks everyone. Again, it's been a really productive call. We have some recommendations, some places where we've identified we need community feedback that we'll make sure we clarify in our initial report. So we'll look for another time and speak to you all then. Thanks again, everybody, and with that, we can end the recording.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. Please remember to disconnect all lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.